This recording is a production of the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee. This presentation was recorded at Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute 2019, held in Montgomery, Indiana, on March 1 and 2.
We want to thank you for giving some questions in the question box. We will not probably have time to address quite all of them. We will address the ones first that directly applied to the topics that these brothers spoke on yesterday, and then we'll proceed to do a few more as time allows. So if your question isn't addressed, why, we still hope that you can find someone here you can talk to about it, or maybe approach someone afterwards individually. So the first question is, who polices the dress code? Our teacher is reluctant to do this. The student is already there, and is it a student or a parent issue? So, Linford, you can lead on that.
So maybe to start with another question, and that is, why is the teacher reluctant? Or he or she, whoever it is it because they know they're going to have to mop up the mess? Is it because they know they have to deal with a disgruntled parent? Maybe the first thing I would suggest is that the teacher know clearly how the process is going to work. We used to, in our school, just if there was a problem at school on a day-to-day basis, we would walk up and just tap the student on the shoulder and say what needed to be changed. If it was a girl, the lady teachers went. If it was a boy, I went. And that worked fine for a number of years, but something has been changing in the last couple of years. I don't know if I can really say exactly what or why, but we had a few difficult situations where girls overreacted and went home and told their parents that it was not handled right, or it was maybe even to the point of shaming. And so we had discussions with these parents, and they wanted to have it handled a different way. They did not like us going to their children at school. And maybe they had a point. Is it really a student issue, or is it a parent issue? And so we took their advice and did it the way they wanted. They wanted an email sent from the administration to them. And since that's the way they would have liked it, we decided to do it that way. I wish I could say that it solved every problem. It hasn't. But it has done one thing. The teachers are not as reluctant now to come to me and say, hey, I noticed this. And then I say, okay, now I go home and I write my email. That maybe takes a little bit of the reluctance out for the teacher.
Thank you. Does someone else have something to add to that? I'll just interject one comment here about email, this electronic communication. Be very cautious. It works very well, and it's very efficient, and it's a way of getting communication across. But in any area that's open to misunderstanding, you're walking in a minefield, because when you word things, you're not sure how the person reading it is going to read it. So that's another subject. Go ahead.
Maybe one more comment there. When dealing with dress code issues, I think it's helpful to try to understand what is driving the problem. What's behind why the student is not following what's going on? What's the issue? There's often something underneath, and if we can address that alongside, is that actually isn't going to work to do this. But if we go a little deeper than that, I think sometimes that can also maybe help address future issues to give some. I think a lot of students aren't always sure why this is such a big deal. or whatever. And they don't have to know everything about that, but they need to understand their own hearts and where they're getting their cues. Why are they doing this? And sometimes they're not aware themselves, and we can actually help them in that process. So maybe just add in a little there.
Anybody else?
One thing I think about is when you have blatant disregard for the rules, very in your face. In that situation, I like to see it dealt with right away. We had a boy that came to school wearing a t-shirt underneath his jacket, and the teacher realized it. He was driving, and he had a vehicle, sent him home to change, and he did that. And it kind of came out that he would have been disappointed if the teacher wouldn't have done something about it. He was just testing the waters, finding out we really meant what we said.
Thank you. Let's move on to another question related to the communication with parents. How do you go about having effective communication with a parent who hates the teacher, does not trust her, will not talk to her? How can the school board intervene? Gerald?
Well, first of all, communication is a two-way street, and so it does need to start going two ways. Couple things, maybe. These are always difficult. A couple things to remember, I think, is that Matthew 18 always applies. A direct approach is always appropriate, and we always start there. And if that appeal is not heard, and by the way, it depends a little bit on the situation. The principal or chairman may need to go with somebody, especially if it's maybe a lady, and if it's a pretty rancid situation and it's pretty hot. You need to protect your staff too at some level, but always Matthew 18. We always start there, and you can lose trust in a moment, and it can take years to regain it. And I think it's always helpful to think about, has the teacher, has the school, has the principal, has the board somehow broken trust with the parent? And how? To also offer that. Is there a problem? What is the problem? And to pursue what's underneath it again. And at the same time, I think at a certain point, the board does need to say, well, this isn't the way we do things. The gospel doesn't call us to this, and we need to resolve this. There needs to be resolution. You don't have to like the teacher, but you need to love her. And because you really can't make someone like someone else, but you can love. And I think the board does have a responsibility to pay attention to those relational issues, to keep their ears open, to understand what happened to get to this point. Is it a personality clash? Is it, what is it? What's actually going on? And that needs to be personally addressed at the lowest level possible and move from there. There have been times when it's appropriate to say to a parent, you know what, I don't think you're a very good fit for this school. We can't operate a school without mutual trust. And we own what are our issues, and the parent needs to own their issues. That might at least be a start. I would say, too, that I don't know what school this is. Obviously, we don't know who submitted these. But if you have a principal in the school, he needs to be frontlining that for the board and needs to be very involved to understand what is going on and should be heading off things before they get to the hate, doesn't trust, won't talk level.
Thank you. Anybody else? All right, let's move on to another question. Do you do the readiness test before kindergarten or after kindergarten? And another question related to that is, how long do you recommend for kindergarten? 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months? How long should this be? So we'll put them together, address them together, and we'll ask Lyndon to start off here.
The readiness test, in my experience at least, should be given after kindergarten. If there is no kindergarten, then we look towards the end of the school year before they would start first grade, giving you at least a summer, the parents a summer to see if they can rectify some issues, that sort of thing. We like to give it right at the end of kindergarten, which leads us into how do you do kindergarten. There are so many ways to do kindergarten. I visit schools that have it every day, all year long, and they are scrambling for material. Other people do kindergarten all year long, but when they get done with kindergarten, they start into phonics very, very slowly. At our school, when I taught first grade, we didn't have kindergarten. We had a future first grader day, and that's a poor substitute. It's not a substitute. It doesn't work. We have finally come to something we're very happy with, I think. It's where we have about 7 to 8 weeks, we kind of leave it open-ended, of kindergarten in the months of February and March, kind of that, well, the first graders are over their initial learning experience. We use our first grade teacher for our kindergarten teacher, and we get someone in to help be an aide to the first graders. We have kindergarten 4 days a week. We have prayer meeting Wednesday night, so Wednesdays are off. We think they need the rest. But Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, so we have 4 days a week, about 7 weeks. If we need to, we can go a little bit longer. And at the end of that time, the readiness test is given. Moms line up to find out where their children were deficient, and we go forward from there. School board can be advised as to how that child, those children have done, where we need to go going forward. Is there parents that need to be contacted about how things are done? But usually that we have a very, I feel like in our community, our culture, we have very good communication between that kindergarten teacher and the parents, working together to for the good of the child, for the good of the child.
I think one thing that's important to realize about the readiness test is that it is not the full and final analysis of the student being prepared. There still needs to be human judgment and common sense and wisdom applied to that decision about whether the child is ready or not. So it's just one tool that you can use. I was in a school several years ago where they had kindergarten all year long. But instead of scrambling for materials, they had a rest period every afternoon. I mean, like they had mats out for all their preschoolers, all their kindergartners, and they had an hour of dark nap time for their students. And I thought it was pretty neat and good idea for stretching the curriculum a little bit.
Sounds like a possible suggestion for an evaluation form here. We need a nap time at Caspi. All right. All right, let's move on to another question. Several, again, these fit together. How can we offer our, quote, professional opinion on first grade age of attendance without overstepping the parents' authority? And yes, actually, let's deal with that by itself, right? How can we offer our, quote, professional opinion without overstepping parents' authority? Ken, do you want to start off on that one? Or
well, that's a how can we do so. Maybe the question should be first, should we offer our professional opinion at the expense of parental preference? I am of the persuasion, after working with this kind of situation for many, many times, when you get into a first grade classroom and the teacher tells me that this child is struggling, and what helps do you have? What can you offer for this first grade student? And I will ask, was he ready for first grade? What is your opinion on that? And or they will actually eventually offer the idea that they really weren't ready for first grade, but the parents wanted them to come. And I pull back on that and just say, you know, if the school board could take their responsibility there and decide what is best for the student, not what is preferable for parents or what is convenient for the teachers, but what is best for the student, it's a good thing. And so I think, you know, aside from their professional opinion there, perhaps it would be good to say, you know, what is best for the child, and then school boards step up to the plate on this one. I'd like to encourage that very much, that if there is a variance of opinion between the parents thinking the child should come to school, and this happens, my child's ready, and it would be a setback for him or her if you wouldn't. But really, it's a setback for the parents more than the student. And so when there is a variance of opinion like that, I think the school board should have the final say. Do it lovingly, carefully, professionally, but you know, what we're doing is for the good of the school and for the child.
We actually have a policy. When a family wants to enroll for the first time in our school, that is one thing they must agree to, that the school board, along with the teaching staff, makes the final call on grade placement.
That's a place where policy certainly helps. Any other comments on that? All right, then we have a question related to parents. What are practical ways to have interaction with manipulative parents with some of their tendencies? Speaking truth, yet keeping insurance for ourselves and our staff. Along with that, what's the core problem with manipulative parents? Must we only deal with the symptoms, or can we get to the root? Mr. Carroll?
That'd be nice to have some easier questions here sometime. The right question. What's underneath some of this? And maybe just say a few things on that. One of the things we need to recognize is that parenting really truly has changed. The culture has pressed in deeply. And I don't think parents are aware of it. My sense is that in our community, there's a growing sense, those that have first graders, they're new parents, they're realizing some of this, beginning to realize what's going on. But there aren't very many people really talking about it. When we talk about having a relationship with our children, the older generation is, when they're talking about it, they're realizing that they didn't have the relationship with their moms and dads they might have wished for. I think that's probably fair to say, that we weren't as warm and relational 40 years ago. Is that okay to say? What's happened is we've swung, I think, on the other side pretty far, and it's all about relationship and making sure the child is happy, and that the child is set up for success in ways that will be the easiest possible for that child. Now, that's not a very good summary, and there's a lot more I could say about that, but I think we have to recognize that. So part of what I'm saying is that I don't think that parents always realize what's actually going on, how they've become influenced. So I find children today, this has always been a problem, all 6,000 years, but children are very selfish because we've parented in a way that makes them the center of their universe. And so that is why this first grade issue comes up so much. That is why it's the overparenting thing. It's why children don't have grit today. They can't do hard things. We've made it so simple for them. I had a parent recently ask me, he said, well, in the question of technology and screen time for children, he said, what should I feel guilty? He said, I feel guilty when I'm on the computer doing things I need to do, but I don't let my two-year-old on a screen. I said, well, the rules are different for children than adults, right? And so they're asking good questions, but that's the sensitivity that parents have today. And if you're over 40, it's not a bad idea to think about the difference in what we mean when we say things. So let me circle back and say that, so when we talk about child training in church and school, whatever, what's being said is being interpreted two different ways. And so compassion feels like, or a relationship feels like that, well, we dote on, we really take care of, make sure that there's nothing hard for this child. Fundamentally, that's flawed. And so I guess I'm doing some with the core, and I'm suggesting, I'm beginning to realize, and Jonas has said this for about as long as I've known him, that schools need to start thinking about how to train parents. I think you might have been onto something there. And so I'm beginning to realize that we're talking past each other in church life even. We actually aren't speaking the same language. And schools are in a pretty good position. Now I'm talking bigger picture. I need to be quiet here. In the big picture, I don't think that people realize. I talked to a board chairman who was substituting for several weeks for their high school teacher, and he said, I learned more in those 4 weeks about students and what life is really like than I had before this. Been a chairman for a long time, excellent, excellent chairman. And he said, I didn't realize some of this. And so even our pastors don't have the inside track there in the same way that we as teachers, principals do. And I think it's up to us to begin to say, can we talk about this? We don't lead the discussion necessarily or anything like that. It's, can we talk about this? And let's not talk past each other, because there's a language barrier going on. I think we have been too afraid to say the truth. I find young parents willing to listen. And yet older people, we are so, be included, I'm so intimidated by them. I don't know what that is. It's because there's definitely a difference. I want to make sure we communicate. And so I'm pushing past that personally, and I'm starting to say things to parents about what I think is going on. And it's received well overall, but it's really, really hard, and it's time consuming. I better be quiet here.
Thank you. Other comments?
Well, I invite you, Gerald, to go ahead and write an article on this thing and expand on it, help us to understand it better. I think it is very real. And I think one of the reasons that this is occurring, manipulative parents talking past each other, not really connecting and understanding school life and how things function, and coming into conflict because of that, is varying views of school and schooling. That's some of it. The traditional model has been that school and school staff are in loco parentis, or the Latin phrase, in the place of parents. Parents have delegated the responsibility to the school for their academic developments and even spiritual and moral education and development. However, today's culture, it's shifting, like Gerald has suggested, it's shifting to where they want to be more involved. There's a partnership that they're longing for, and it comes out sometimes in a way of manipulation and not really respecting or fully actually releasing that delegated responsibility to the school. That is something that I think we're seeing and we need to deal with. And perhaps as board members begin to address how this functions and what is the responsibility of the school and what are the parents' responsibilities to the school as well.
Can I just add in here that I think you're exactly right. And one of the things that's happened, I think, is that parents do want the involvement. It's just they feel empowered by all the knowledge. I had a parent ask to speak with me last week. The couple came in, sat at my desk, and they handed me a sheaf of papers that thick, and they printed all of them off of the internet. That stated why their child should not have been graded on a timed word list. Okay, and there's articles, and they can defend that. And I thought to myself, my carnal self, I said, I bet I could go on the internet and find 15 articles that defend my position. You see, so knowledge is empowering at some level. What we need to do is think through how we're going to respond to those issues. They're trying to be helpful. They care so much, but it's maybe not the best way to go about, but that means we have to teach them how. How do you go about making this appeal? And that's a long story, that particular situation. But I think we have to be willing to talk about how we go about these things, what's appropriate, and talk about the place of school and home, parents, how this functions together.
Thank you. Anyone else?
And after 7 weeks of conversations go by, you might just still have to walk away and bear the accusation that it wasn't handled right. We've sat in board meetings already for hours trying to decide how we're going to approach this and realizing this question here had something about saving some insurance for yourself. And you just can't always. Sometimes you just have to know that they're going to make a loser out of you. And pray and go on your way. You did the best you could. And don't let them and I'm glad this is always the minority, only a handful. The most are very supportive. But one of the ways they manipulate you is to point to the things you haven't been doing. You haven't been praising enough. You haven't been encouraging enough. And you know what? Yeah, of course I could have did better. You always can do better. But you just have to walk away sometimes.
Thank you. You've touched on something there that actually expands the subject, I think, appropriately. There's always been the strong personality, the person who's not a team player but has these ideas of how things ought to be done and maybe even willing to fund them if they're done his way. But I think, as what you touched on, something larger here, this is true in the secular world. There are writers recognizing this. For those of you who like to read, you can look up books by Leonard Sachs, S-A-X. He's a pediatrician who's been practicing for 20 to 30 or more years, and he chronicles a distinct change in the way parents relate to their children. He's had parents, of course, bringing children to the office, and he's been around speaking and addresses this subject. His most recent book is The Collapse of Parenting, a little read, How We Harm Our Children by Trying to Treat Them Like Adults. It's fascinating to hear someone write about this from that perspective. And he touches on many parents actually don't feel that they have authority to give their children simple directions. They no longer use the imperative mood. If you understand you can have declarative sentences and then you can have imperative. Imperative things are things such as come sit in daddy's lap. And they no longer feel able to do that. And the focus on the children has become almost, I would say, almost to the point of idolatry. It's they're setting their children up to be the center of the world. And so it is a huge subject, and it's something that we need to be aware of. And probably you simply have to talk about it as a school family, being aware of these influences and how we're going to function. All right, let's move on to another question. This is another one for the ready or not. We have a girl in our school who has completed first grade 3 times and was moved on afterward. She can still not read and is already 12 years old. What would be the next step to take in a situation like this? Lyndon?
One thing that maybe some of you at least perceived yesterday from my talk was that keeping a child out of school another year is a fix-all situation. That's not so. It can help the situation. It does not harm the child for that to happen. But at some point, we have to move forward. We cannot just say, well, we're going to keep them out of school another year and another year and another year like that. I would suggest that at age 7, they need to be enrolled in school. But we do have to realize there are varying abilities in different children. And maybe this child will never, what we call, succeed at school. We need to put forth effort as well. And that's where you as school board, you're going to have to use wisdom and discernment as to know how you're going to go forward with that case and that situation. Are you just going to put that child into the first grade situation with other students? That's good for her. She needs that. Those peers around her. But then expect the teacher to use 25, 35, 40% of her time just for that child when there are 10 other students in the classroom? Is that fair to the other children? What can be done then to find some extra help? Whether it's volunteer, whether we as a school board hire someone, a resource teacher, special ed teacher, someone that can work with a situation. And that child may never excel in school. We've had several cases in our school where after an appropriate number of years in our school system, the child doing the best they could, teachers doing the best they could to help that child, we gave them not a diploma, but a certificate of completion, saying, you know, you have completed, and we are satisfied and happy with what you have done in our school, and here is a token from the school for your efforts in your trying to learn. Those children, many of them work harder than those children that are getting 95s and 100s, and we need to recognize that in some way.
I think the other thing I'd really encourage us to do is test. There are people that can test children. If you're not sure who to talk to, talk to somebody who's been down the road. But test early on to understand what's going on, because there's a problem. And it might not be as hard to fix as we think, where at least there's a functional reading level. So don't wait till they're 12, would be my plea. Start in early, get that testing done, understand what's actually going on, rather than just tutoring, which ends up being a band-aid if you have a real issue that tutoring won't solve. That's a band-aid then. And really work at understanding what's going on and what kind of thing will really help that child. My goal is not that every child comes out Albert Einstein, it's that they can function well in church life and in the world. So reading is such a central skill there. Please test. There's people out there that know a lot more than, for sure, me, and probably more than most of us about learning disabilities. I plead with you, help those children get a hold of what's going on. There is help available.
Thank you. Moving on to another question. How much should parents be allowed to pull their children out of school for travel or other activities? Linford.
So what is changing again in culture that this is increasing? There might be a couple reasons for that. I think when I was young, I think I'm kind of on the very end of maybe an age of history where our communities were very church-centered. And now it seems like we're more family-centered, where the dad is the patriarch and the dad makes the calls about many of these decisions, and not so much the church. There's also a spiraling increase in affluence, so people can take their vacations. And there's also more opportunities to do service. I just did a PT meeting at a small church up in the PA, where it is some of the families are going to go into service with CAM. One of the families will go to Maranatha Bible School, and that is expected and supported. That is their culture. They do that there. But there's a few things that we've run into at our school, mostly along the line of the affluence. We can and so we will. We spent a lot of time over about a 10-year period trying to change our school from individualized to conventional, because that's what everyone wanted. But because of so much taking off, I almost wish we were individualized again. You could do that kind of thing better then. You start thinking about that the 20 children in a classroom are each going to take off 5 days a year, do the math, and think about how many days are the teacher is going to have someone out of the classroom. So we finally made a policy that if you take over 5 days off in a year as a family, your enrollment is forfeited. That may seem like a very strong policy, I don't know, but we did come to do that. And we decided to do it now while it was still a growing problem before it got out of hand. So hopefully this will begin to help to change the culture going forward, because the problem is only going to get worse. And so far they are respecting that, even so much as to call me in August before the year starts. When are you taking teacher visitation day? Because they want to tack 4 days on the end of that one, you know, so they can take their week's vacation. Things like that. So the unfortunate thing is, now the 5 days, it's not seen as a threat. Those 5 days off are my right. So I'm finished.
All right, I think we'll need to stop here. The clock is moving on too. So we'll transition back now, and thank you, brothers. And we'll ask Victor to come up and tell us where we're going from here.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.